a man-made universe as a work of art. Even as a wizard, I was unable to conjure up an absolute frame out of thin air for my synthetic cosmology, which adopted the geo-peripheral universe as its physical base, and with no pressure on me to lie, I admitted that it was my own subjective creation. I developed my cosmology without directly knowing of Whitehead's earlier carefully expressed philosophical process theory, which coincidentally he based on the same differentiations of involving intentionality, evolving extensionality, and most important of all, eventuality as the key concept with the potential for sudden qualitative upgrading. It can also be described as a non-materialistic artwork in progress designed by the shamanic living work of art to spellbind, reintegrate, revitalize, and provide therapy for an increasingly obsessional, fearful, and hysterical civilization. In 1974, in spite of insane and ferocious student opposition from the Maoist Student Representative Council, at a specially convened meeting of the union, the process cosmology I had created as their official cosmologer was authorized to be published by the University Union of Melbourne University as part of my infamous Wizard's Nonsense Almanac for 1974. The Living Work of Art. At their annual conference in Hamburg in 1969, I was appointed official Wizard of the World University Service, commissioned to tour universities in Australia with a fun revolutionary show combining the new rock and roll music with recent social science theories involving the now open-ended process diagram. 2 years later, after conferring with the curator of the Metropolitan Museum of New York, director of the National Gallery of Victoria announced to the media that in his opinion, I had become the world's first living work of art. The idea was to experiment with the nature of aesthetics as process, like music and dance, rather than as idols or commodities, and to question the values implicit in the role of artistic institutions in deciding which art forms to support. This had been the subject of my suddenly terminated PhD thesis in the sociology of art. In normal times, these unprecedented events would have provoked vigorous discussion and given me a high personal profile, for which I was prepared. But they passed uncommented upon and no further interest was forthcoming. It was ignored by serious commentators and the popular mass media treated the news as a mildly losing joke by the eccentric. This gave me considerable pause for thought. What was now new enough to be called news? What was creative enough to be called art? Were genuinely new ideas and their accompanying social actions too dangerous to be discussed in the public forum? The living work of art also aestheticizes art itself by taking it into the existential world, free from the distortions of economic or political determinism. The motivation of many artists in the blob is to produce agitprop artworks that will secure grants made by arts bureaucrats out of compulsory taxation. Art in both its commercial forms as commodities or paid entertainments, or its ideological form as conceptual art and installations loaded with ideological gobbledygook, has lost the magical qualities of great creativity. Successful artists have turned their backs on deeper sorts of meaning and narrative to become ultra-controversial, well-paid providers of escape from boredom, or fixated on shallow virtue signaling from the high moral ground of political correctness. Others, showing severe signs of growing modernist schizophrenia, are supported by bored and satiated nouveau riche patrons for their shock value. Some definitions of art. A self is probably the most impressive work of art we ever produce. This quotation is from Jerome Bruner, to which I will add one from Wittgenstein. The work of art does not aim to convey something else, just itself. Another quote. Art is not created from moral or rational principles, but from the depth of the soul of a people. The myth is the expression of that unique soul. But as soon as we try to objectify or rationally explain its relevance, we slowly kill our cultural life and replace it with a clinical, materialistic worldview. This worldview is the modern one, where we have literally killed the belief in religion, passion, magic, and myth because we no longer understand their function. We search for objective answers to the myth itself. And unsurprisingly, we don't find one. Because the truth about life, according to Nietzsche, does not lie in the myth itself, but in its metaphorical expression of life. Jacques Bazin insists that with its mechanical and historical bias, evolution reduced everything to something else. From fear of being anthropomorphic, it de-anthropomorphized man. In a pamphlet called The Abolition of Man, later expanded dramatically into his most prophetic book, That Hideous Strength, C.S. Lewis summed up the metaphysical basis of the soulless, managerialized blob. It seems that without consciously intending it, ego, I am, is its greatest adversary, though I would be greatly relieved to find a greater pure egoist than myself that I could support. I take my fundamental stand as the world's only living work of art. The role was legitimated many years ago by art gallery directors in Australia and New Zealand, and with support from the curator of the Met in New York, before they were all absorbed into the blob and went silent about my very prominent existence in their midst. The blob politicizes. The living work of art aestheticizes. The aestheticizing process, which began as I was studying for my doomed doctorate in the sociology of art, flowered in the patterns which arise in the depths of my psyche and from which the superconscious realm of heavenly inspiration as physical, psychological, sociological, and cultural theories began to shape themselves into interacting processual form. The blob politicizes. The living work of art aestheticizes. The aestheticizing process, which began as I was standing for my doomed doctorate, flowered in the patterns which were arising from the depths of my psyche and from the superconscious realm of heavenly inspiration as physical, psychological, sociological, and cultural theories began to shape themselves into interacting processual forms. It was an epiphany. I could see similarities between what I was experiencing and the beautiful cosmological diagrams of the late 16th and early 17th century magician science. By 1972, in my department of cosmology, on the campus at Melbourne University, I produced a set of interrelated diagrams. The most important of these took the form of the Tree of Life and Caduceus. Others were the experienceable mandala-like double dialectical kinematics and the nesting concentric spheres representing evolving nesting systems of location, space, involving nesting systems of identity and the probabilistic event hierarchy of time. Like Puck, I put a girdle about the Earth by making a conformal inversion of the current mathematical coordinates of the physical universe. If there is no absolute frame, then the resultant inside-out geoperipheral model is no more falsifiable than the old heliocentric model of the 17th century mechanists, which was accepted for its usefulness to the military, for its contribution to the science of ballistics. Occam's razor was no help in choosing between them. Any decision would be decided by its usefulness and to whom. As an Anglican postmodern prophet, I could announce that heaven, the centre of the universe, was now directly above the Earth's surface again. In my new model, heaven becomes the real singularity, with a specific if unreachable location, and satanic materialists will be rendered incoherent with rage as the false absolutism of their universe was unmasked. I planned an imagination experiment in personal transcendence, a shamanic ascension of the cosmic axis, and set off to New Zealand to attempt it.